Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the ALPLM. And now here are your hosts, Dr. Jacob Freefeld and Corinne Claycomb.
Well, hello and welcome to the State of Sound podcast. My name is Corinne Claycomb with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. On today's episode, Joe Crane sat down with Kevin Cronin of ARIA Speedwagon to learn a little bit more about their Midwestern legacy and their journey to where they are today. Before we get too far into ARIA Speedwagon, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Jacob Freefeld. Hey, Jake.
Hi, Corinne. Yes, I'm Jake Freefeld. I'm the historian of Illinois and the Midwest here at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. And today we are talking about Kevin Cronin and ARIA Speedwagon. ARIA formed in 1966, and like many bands of that era, they grew out of youth culture, sparked in part by the Beatles, in particular the 1964 Ed Sullivan appearance, which sparked this youth culture in the United States. And kids and young adults were jamming in their garages and apartments, pretending, you know, that they were the Beatles. And it's within this cultural moment on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign that ARIA Speedwagon forms in 1966. Now, the original band of Neil Dowdy, Alan Gratzer, Gary Richrath, Greg Philbin, as well as Terry Luttrell and vocals, they released their first album in 1971. This is not an album that launches them into superstardom. They're still popular in the Midwest, but they haven't hit the mainstream yet. Luttrell ends up leaving the band shortly after that, and this is when Kevin Cronin first joins the band in 1972. This doesn't really work out. There's a lack of balance between Cronin's folk music and the band's rockin' style. So Mike Murphy then takes over as the frontman, and they release three albums. They hit their first Billboard chart. Not a huge success, though. It doesn't throw them into superstardom again. In 76, the band wants to change frontmen again, and Kevin Cronin returns, and they figure out the balance this time, and they come out with more albums. The live album, you've got what you pay for. You can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish, which is still one of the greatest album titles, I think, in history. And this,
I think I have that one, actually, yeah.
It's just a great album title at the very least. And these give them their first gold and platinum albums, which is extremely important for the band. It puts them in the mainstream. But however, Corinne, in late 1980, they release the album that will make them mentioned in the same breath as bands like Styx and Journey. And that's High Infidelity.
Yeah, I would say ARIA Speedwagon basically crushed it in the 1980s. Like, the 1980s, that was their decade. They really solidified their status as a major rock band. High Fidelity, which was their, like, ninth studio album at this time, like, they had been at it for a while. That was released late 1980 in November, but it really took off in the spring of 81. And the album spent 65 weeks up in the charts, over 30 of those weeks hovering kind of right up there around the top. And it had hits like Keep On Loving You, which reached number one, Take It On The Run, In Your Letter. The album eventually sells over 10 million copies, which basically means you get the Diamond Award. And that's the one that's actually on display in the State of Sound exhibit right now. So please come by and take a look at it. It's really cool. But the album was a little bit of a departure for them in that they were adopting more of a pop-forward sound in contrast to their earlier hard rock leanings. But Cronin, in the interview you'll hear, he kind of talks about how the public embraced and fell in love with ARIA Speedwagon because their songs spoke to them. People could relate to the music and felt that they knew this band. They really knew these guys and shared similar experiences. High Fidelity has this really great blend of a hard rocking hit, power ballads, and just genuine all-around feel-good tracks. And they continued that success during the 80s. A couple years later, they came up with Good Trouble. On that one, we've got Keep the Fire Burning, The Key, Sweet Time. 2 years later, they're just plucking right along, continuing that success. They released Wheels Are Turning. And in my notes, I have Turning, ING, but actually the title of it is Turnin'. They dropped the G, which is a typical classic Midwestern thing. I'm guilty of it myself. Wheels are turning. And that one is where they have the number one hit, Can't Fight This Feeling. That is one of their biggest hits ever. In addition to One Lonely Night, I Do Want to Know, Live Every Moment. And it's around the middle of the decade that they start touring the U.S., playing a sold-out show in Wisconsin, which cements their status as a Midwestern darling. But around the 90s, that's when things kind of come to a head within the band. Just kind of a too many cooks in the kitchen kind of situation. Alan Braxer, he just decided to retire. Like, he was just ready to kind of, you know, put the music thing to bed and a few other things. But Gary Rich Rath decided to walk away because of too many disagreements with Cronin. So Rich Rath starts his own band titled Rich Rath. But eventually, and we'll hear more about this from Cronin in the interview, Cronin and Rich Rath were actually able to kind of put the past behind them and work together and kind of reestablish their friendship, which is really fortunate because they were able to come back together before Rich Rath's death in 2015. And late 90s and beyond, they found this revival in their music. What they and their label discovered was that people were just really hungry for those big hits from the early 80s. If you turn on a radio anywhere in the Midwest right now, I can guarantee you one of their songs will be playing. They're just, you know, a Midwestern thing. They're all around. They're just, you know, a big deal. And they still tour to this day. I think we'll hear in the interview, Cronin is pretty much chomping at the bit to get back out on the road. And when he does, they'll probably be coming to an amphitheater near you.
And you mentioned there's this this Midwestern feel of REO Speedwagon. It's almost quintessential, yeah. Illinois, right? No one's going to walk into the State of Sound exhibit at the ALPLM, look at REO Speedwagon and say, oh, well, that's not an Illinois band, right? They're so Illinois. Members from Champaign, Peoria, East St. Louis, Chicago. They've got the whole state covered. And I like that Cronin gets a little bit philosophical on what it means to be from Illinois during the interview as well.
Yeah, he kind of captures what Illinois is all about. It's about working hard and playing hard and having a good time. And I think that's what they were able to put into their music, and I think that's what the public really gets from it. You know, they just they speak our language, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And now I think it's time to turn it over to our director of programming, Joe Crane, and his interview with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon.
Kevin Cronin, lead singer, REO Speedwagon. Welcome aboard to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum State of Sound Studio.
Wow, what a what an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've visited a few presidential museums over the years. I kind of dig them. So it's like I say, I'm honored to be part of this. It's very cool.
One of our longtime folks tells me a few years back when you were performing one of your many concerts in Springfield, you actually made it to the museum one day before one of your concerts.
As a matter of fact, I did. I saw the. You know, I saw President Lincoln's top hat, among other things, and I did. I toured the place. As a matter of fact, it must have been 1969-ish. I took a road trip. I grew up in Chicago, so I just took a road trip, and I didn't know exactly where I was going to go. I was by myself. It was one of those times where you want to just be kind of alone with your thoughts. And I found myself on the way to Springfield, Illinois. And I visited the museum back then. And I also drove outside of town. And there's a little place near where Abraham Lincoln's birthplace, the little cabin. And it's called Prairie Run. I don't even know if it's still there. But there was that music pavilion called the Illinois Opry. And
Petersburg. That's New Salem, where he came as a young man from Kentucky, right?
New Salem, that's it. And so I just happened to be there. I sat down in the pavilion because there was a band that was going to be playing that night, and they were rehearsing, doing their sound check, I guess. And it was the first time that I heard live country music. And it just, I was so inspired. I came home and wrote a song called The Ballad of the Illinois Opry, which actually appeared on an REO Speedwagon album.
Found myself heading down towards Springfield. The last sign said it was 12 miles west.
So I feel a soulful connection, you know, as an Illinois boy, proud of my Illinois roots, proud to be part of the Illinois music scene. And so there you go. I do feel a soulful connection to Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was one of the great presidents of our country's history. And, you know, so proud Illinois boy you're talking to here.
All right. Of course, Kevin, REO Speedwagon, a great rock and roll band in the same sense. And the band's roots date back to the mid-60s with Neil Dowdy, who remains with the band today, and Adam Gratzer, who met up at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. But I want to start our conversation back in the spring of 1981.
And I'm going to keep on.
Years ago, about right now, when the band was, by any measure, Kevin, the hottest band in rock and roll. High Infidelity had been released and was huge. As I understand it, you knew early on that High Infidelity was going to be a huge success. When did you know that?
Well, you know, you never know for sure. You know, there's so many factors that that come into play. The stars have to be lined up just perfectly. But I will say that during the recording of that record, there was a closeness among the band members. There was, you know, all of our lives were, our personal lives were in similar disarray, as the case may be, and so that even brought us closer, and it caused the songs that we wrote for that record to kind of be coming from a similar viewpoint, similar state of mind. And so the record took on a personality of its own. And, you know, we didn't plan it to be a concept album. If we tried to plan it to be a concept album, we would never have been able to do it, because we're just a bunch of knuckleheads from, you know, from Illinois, right? But it kind of became an accidental concept album. And so when you feel that kind of closeness within the band, and the songs were just soulful songs, and they were songs about things that people go through in real life, and people heard that music and immediately became attached to it. Because we played some of the songs before the album came out, when no one had even heard them, because we were touring, because we had to survive, and we were getting audience reactions to songs like "Keep on Loving You" and "Don't Let Him Go" and "Take It on the Run," that were, you know, you would have thought that people had already heard them and they were already hits. So that gave us a feeling that that we had something. And, you know, then of course the stars lined up in many ways. And that album was a juggernaut. I think it's the definition of a juggernaut. But it was an amazing time, and it was 40 years ago right now. Seems like a long time ago, and it seems like yesterday at the same time.
It seems like yesterday for me. That's when I was first starting out as a baby disc jockey in high school, and I remember those days well. And the title of the album, obviously a play on words, calls to mind the unofficial credo of rock music: sex, drugs, and rock and roll. What led the band to decide on the name High Infidelity? It's a clever name for an album.
Well, thank you. I was on my way into the studio, driving down the Ventura Freeway here in Los Angeles. I had a convertible. The top was down. I had a rough mix of "Don't Let Him Go" cranked through my car sound system, and all I can tell you is it felt like that title dropped out of the sky into my lap. I just thought of it, and I immediately knew that was going to be the title of our new album. I also knew that it had the potential of being controversial because of what you just explained. And, you know, when I told the guys in the band about it, when I got to the studio, everybody's jaw dropped. They're like, wait a minute, can we name our album High Infidelity? And but it was just, it just had to be. It was like the music named itself. And one of the things that I thought of to soften it a bit was change the word high from H-I-G-H to just H-I, like hi. So that kind of made it feel a little more warm and cozy to me. But it just worked, and you can't deny the catchiness of it, and the controversial nature of it didn't seem to get in the way of the album's success. So I guess it was the right move.
Right time, right name at the right time. Now, one of the really impressive items on display in our State of Sound exhibit is the Diamond Sales Award that recognizes High Infidelity's, as you said, you know, just the phenomenal success, 10 million albums sold. What does that award mean to you and to the rest of the band?
Oh, man, Joe, that was just it was humbling. It was a source of pride. It's like, you know, we kind of looked at ourselves and went, because a phenomenon. I mean, High Infidelity was a phenomenon. Let's face it, in that particular time. So the band made such a giant leap in popularity and in, you know, we were always pretty. We had done really well in Illinois, and we spread it a little bit to the neighboring states, but High Infidelity kind of put us on the map nationally and internationally. It just, you know, everything just kind of exploded. And that little trophy that's on display there at the Presidential Museum in Illinois encapsulates all of that. So, when I look at that, because I've got one sitting on my mantle here, you know, and it's, you know, I don't dwell on it, but every once in a while I walk past it and you kind of pinch yourself and go, wow, did that really happen? Or was that just something I dreamed? Because basically every dream that I had as a kid starting to take guitar lessons, it all came true and then some, you know. So it was pretty amazing. Now, of course, you know, with anything, there's also the flip side. And I'm in the midst of writing a book as we speak. I'm about 4.5 years into it. And I tell the story of, you know, of the flip side of the humongous success, because, you know, I had convinced myself that as soon as that all my problems and all my insecurities and all my issues would suddenly disappear if the band hit it big. And of course that was a false way of thinking about things, because that's not what happened. So it's, you know, it's like anything in life, you know, with anything that happens to you, there's always the other side of the coin that you have to deal with. And it was good for me, because in realizing that it wasn't all wrapped up in the success of the band, it forced me and caused me to, you know, to look inside and to figure out some things that I needed to figure out. So in the long run, High Infidelity was just an amazing experience on every level. And, you know, but you, again, you have to learn from every experience. And I learned plenty about it, about myself through it. And now here we are. We're, you know, as soon as the COVID threat starts to dissipate, and it is finally, I think there's light at the end of the tunnel, and REO Speedwagon is looking at getting back on the road later this year. And with luck, we will be playing a show in Effingham, Illinois, this coming July. And so fingers crossed, and everybody get your vaccinations, and we'll be back.
You're listening to the State of Sound podcast. I'm Joe Crane, and I have the pleasure of speaking with REO Speedwagon frontman Kevin Cronin. Now, of course, you had a couple of starts and stops as REO's lead singer around, 1972, 73, before he finally came on board with the band permanently in 1976. At the time when you came on board, you had more of a background in folk rock, and the band was kind of, you know, a hard-driving rock and roll band. So as you and the late Gary Richrath emerged as the driving forces for the band, how were you able to mesh your folk style with that hard-driving rock sound?
Well, you know, that was definitely the challenge. You know, when Gary and I met accidentally, and again, I tell the whole crazy story in the book, but we were, you know, Gary was from just outside of Peoria down in Pekin, Illinois, and so he was kind of a small town, kind of a, you know, not quite a farm boy, but he had that, he had a country music background that most people aren't aware of. He learned guitar from his uncle Leroy, who was a, you know, kind of a Buck Owens and the Buckaroos kind of guy, you know. So Gary had that kind of country folk thing, you know, at his core, but he kind of, as you say, made his name as a, you know, the hard rock and guitar slinger from REO Speedwagon. He had a presence that was just phenomenal. I mean, when I first saw the band, I couldn't take my eyes off the guy. He just had this sound and this way of playing the guitar that was amazing. And I feel like he is has always been underrated and underappreciated as a guitarist. But you know, guys who play the guitar, they know who Gary Richrath is. And so that was a challenge that because I always liked rock and roll. I was a Beatles guy. And so it took, I mean, that's kind of why things didn't quite work out the first time around. We couldn't figure out a way to keep that mutual respect going. It was almost like it had to be one way or the other, and that wasn't going to work for one of us. And Gary had been in the band longer than me, so I was the one who you know, was kind of asked to leave, to put it politely. But you know, the band went through a couple of albums without me, and I think that my solo career didn't quite explode the way I hoped it would. And so when we got back together, there was a little bit more of a mutual respect there with Gary and I, and we worked things through. And as I said earlier, the stars lined up in High Infidelity. That was kind of where the balance between Gary's thing and my thing kind of just, the balance was there. And, you know, I had Keep On Loving You, he had Take It On The Run. And those two songs were just a 1-2 punch that sent the whole album into the stratosphere. And the beauty of it was that all the albums that preceded it, you know, REOTWO, You Can Tune a Piano But You Can't Tune a Fish, 9 Lives, those three records, which had all done okay, suddenly, you know, a lot of people were hearing REO Speedwagon for the first time with High Infidelity, and all those albums came back on the charts and ended up going platinum plus. So it was, that made the year 1981 even that much more special.
You take it on the run, baby, if that's the way you want it, baby, then I don't want it.
Absolutely, but unfortunately, as you mentioned a little while ago, there, you know, with the success, there's the one side of the coin, but there's also some other issues and pressures that come up on the other side of the coin. And unfortunately, that collaboration between you and Gary ended around 1989 when he left the band. I would imagine that just as those different approaches could have a positive impact on the creative process, Kevin, those differences also contributed to the parting of ways. Looking back, do you have some second thoughts on how that working relationship ultimately played out?
Well, you know, it was, you know, when you have a relationship that relies so much on striking a balance, if things get out of balance on either side, it has an effect on the partnership. And as I said, you know, the stars were really close during You Can Tune a Piano But You Can't Tune a Fish. We hit it in High Infidelity. We were really close on Wheels Are Turning. And by 1987, Life As We Know It, things just got out of balance. And I love Gary with all my being. And I owe him so much for having, you know, seeing me as a, you know, when I was just a young folk singer in Chicago, and recognizing something in me that no one else had. Alan left the band after the 1987 tour, and it didn't take long for things to start unraveling. Alan was really a big part of the glue, you know, because Gary and I, as I said, we're always looking for balance. Alan was really good at helping us to find that balance. You know, when he left, I think, you know, he didn't mean it to happen this way, but his kind of even keel, level headed, he's a really smart guy. And you know, so you take one piece out of a puzzle, and suddenly the puzzle, other pieces start, you know, moving around as well. I wish that, you know, I'm sad that Gary wasn't around, to experience the great resurgence that REO Speedwagon experienced starting in about 1995, and it goes on to this day. That music just stuck to people's ribs, and you know, it was a shame because, you know, Gary was a big part of creating that music. So yeah, it was unfortunate, and it makes me sad when I think about it, honestly, and especially with Gary having passed away. You know, you'd like to see yourself riding off into the sunset together, you know, getting together on the front porch and talking about old times, and you know, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And it is worth noting that Gary didn't completely go away. He did rejoin the band on a few occasions to hop on stage for an encore song or two, most notably at that 2013 Tornado Relief concert in Bloomington. So I guess it seems fitting that the final performance between you and Gary would be a benefit to help people back home in Illinois.
That was, I mean, there was poetic justice in that, Joe, for sure. Gary had just, he'd been living in Los Angeles for all those years. And I heard that he had moved back to Peoria, and he actually, he and his wife bought a house on a hill, you know, and that he was going to be moving and resettling back in Peoria, which I thought would be really great for him. And then coincidentally, when the Washington, Illinois tornado hit, and we kind of, you know, all the bands that are in your exhibit there at the museum came together, and we put on this amazing benefit concert. It was just such a phenomenal thing, and it felt so good to be coming back to Illinois and helping out our home state, because that's what bands are supposed to do. You know, if something happens in Texas, well, ZZ Top and you know, something, you know what I mean? So you gotta take care of your own, you know, and if everyone does that, then it keeps the whole thing together. And the fact that Gary happened to be there and was available to come and join us, that was, he came out for the final song of that concert, Riding the Storm Out, which is a song that he wrote and was really REO Speedwagon's first notable song. That was actually the last time I saw him. And luckily, we had connected over a couple of years before that, and so it's I'm very fortunate that when he passed, we were on fairly good terms. We had reconnected, and again, you know, this is the Reader's Digest version. That, you know, the whole story is, you know, if I ever finish this book, people will be able to read what the details, you know.
Yeah, you talk about L.A. earlier. Of course, that the time the band was forming their home base in L.A. back in the late 70s as REO Speedwagon was starting to really take off. And about that time, you're in need of a new bass guitarist. It would have been very easy to sign up any number of talented musicians in the Southern California rock scene at the time. But instead, the band reached back to its roots and brought Champaign native Bruce Hall on board. Bruce, of course, still with the band today. Was that a conscious effort to go back to Illinois to find a new bass guitar player?
Well, I'll tell you, I met Bruce back when I first joined the band in 1972 at a party in Alan Gratcher's apartment. I was sitting at the piano just tinkering around, and all of a sudden I see this big blonde dude sitting on the piano bench next to me singing harmony. And, you know, I was a kind of a nice blend. He, you know, we kind of, there was a connection there, you know, and so Bruce was always on my radar. You know, I used to go see him with his band where he was the lead singer. They used to play at the Red Lion in Champaign all the time. And, so I was a Bruce Hall fan, from way back. So when Greg Philbin, left the band, to me, it was a no-brainer. It was, you know, the first call went to Bruce, and he was on a plane a couple of days later, and he's been with us ever since. And he and I are, I mean, every musical adventure that I've gone on, whether in REO Speedwagon, some side projects that I did, Bruce has always been with me. He's just a tremendous musician and just a good guy. And, yeah, it was a no-brainer.
All right. Now, of course, our exhibit, State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, a celebration of music and musicians from Illinois. Kevin Cronin, how does Illinois continue to influence you as an artist?
Well, I think, I think we're all influenced by our upbringings, by the way we were raised, by our surroundings, by the people we interacted with. And, you know, I don't think I left the state of Illinois until I was, you know, in high school, except to go up to Michigan for a vacation once in a while. The idea of moving to California was something that I thought was just a temporary thing. We were just going to go out there because the best recording studios were in LA. I never expected to end up here full time. I'm an Illinois boy, born and bred. There's a certain mentality that I think everyone in Illinois kind of shares. And it's if you boil it down, it's like it's a responsibility. It's a work ethic. It's the idea of loyalty to friends and family. And then when the weekend comes, let's have some fun. So I think, again, it's balance. It's a balance between hard work and loyal dedication and being able to, you know, let loose and have a good time when the time is right. And I think Illinois just being right in the heart of the country, I think that, again, you know, I get, as we're talking here, we keep coming back to the idea of balance. And I think Illinois is kind of the fulcrum of America. You know, we're right there, man. So I feel it was a great privilege to have been born in Illinois. You know, all of us could have been born anywhere in the world. And there's never been a moment where I have wished that I grew up somewhere else. I've always been a proud Illinois boy, and as REO Speedwagon tours around the world, we share that message. I mean, I talk about Illinois all the time. I talk about, you know, being from Chicago. I talk about the band being from Champaign, the home of the University of Illinois. We had a Chicago boy, a Peoria boy, an East St. Louis boy. You know, Neil was from he was from the southern part of the state, or the southeast, the southwestern part of the state. Bruce from Champaign. I would not wish to have been born and bred anywhere else than in the great state of Illinois.
Well, over the years, of course, REO Speedwagon has done countless tours, several tours, in fact, with fellow Illinois bands Styx in Chicago, recorded 16 studio albums, 7 live albums, 15 compilation albums, even a REO Speedwagon Christmas album, not to mention releasing an online video game a few years ago, appearing on the Netflix series Ozark just last year. Beside the book that you mentioned a little while ago that you're in the process of writing, is there anything else you or the band still want to accomplish?
That's a really good question, Joe. I mean, being home for the past 14 months, that's the longest I've been off tour in my adult life. So it gives you a chance to kind of reflect and think about life and what you want to do. I can say that most of my bucket list items, I never had a bucket list, but if I did, it'd be pretty empty at this point, because I've been so fortunate that our music has just, as I said earlier, just stuck to people's ribs and people, starting with the people of Illinois, you know, they gave us our foundation, and without them, we would have never accomplished anything, because we always, you know, as we struggled through the 70s, you know, with missteps and albums that didn't turn out the way we wanted them. And we always had that solid foundation of the people of Illinois who were cheering us on. I'm really excited about finishing this book. The book is, it started by accident, and it just kind of, the way it unfolded was that it kind of follows my song. You know, my songs kind of create my life story, as well as the story of REO Speedwagon. So I'm also planning to put together, I'm in the process of putting together a musical companion piece for the book, which, you know, is, I've never made a solo album. And so this would be probably the closest thing to a solo album, but it kind of just goes along with the book. I'm looking forward to doing an audio version of the book where I'll, you know, it'll be my voice, you know, which sounds like fun. The band is going to be going out next. We're doing a bunch of dates, hopefully in the second part of 2021, and then in 2022 we have a massive tour planned with, and you know, we'll be announcing the lineup and all the details when everything is solidified. But I'm looking forward to a big tour in 2022 with a brand new set list and hopefully some surprises for people that have seen us a number of times over the years. We want to give them something brand new. You know, and you know, having not played out in 15 months, you know, we got some rust to deal with, you know, so we've got a couple of weeks of production rehearsals coming up, and it's exciting. It's also a little scary, I'll be honest with you, but I think once we all get together and strap on our guitars and start jamming, hopefully it will be more like riding a bike than falling off a bike. That's my hope. And then we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens from there.
Well, I know you and the rest of REO Speedwagon chomping at the bit to get back out on the road, and I know your legions of fans would love to see that. In the meantime, we sure appreciate your time. Kevin Cronin, REO Speedwagon's lead singer, for spending some time with us here on the State of Sound podcast.
My pleasure, man. I'm on behalf of the whole band, we are just tickled to death to be part of this this exhibit, and as I said, to be native Illinois boys. We always will be.
Well, I hope this summer when you make some dates out to our part of the country, you have a little time to squeeze in and come see the exhibit and hang out for a little bit here in Springfield.
That'd be awesome. How long is this exhibit planning to run?
Mid-January of 2022, so you got plenty of time.
Nice. That sounds good. Well, I know we have a date in Effingham coming up in July, and if there's a day off on either side of it, I'm gonna be there for sure. So
yeah, just give us a call and we'll roll out the red carpet for you. All right. Well, Kevin, thank you again. Thank you so much for your time, and have a great weekend, my friend.
Well, welcome back. This is the wrap-up portion of the State of Sound podcast, kind of the behind-the-scenes after-party, if you will. And I'm joined once again by my co-host, Jacob Freefeld. And we are with Joe Crane talking about his interview with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. How are you doing, Joe?
Hi, very good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Joe, let's hop right into it. I loved parts of this interview where Kevin Cronin got very retrospective about Illinois. I also loved him talking about previous band members. What struck you most in that moment?
I just the fact that he was very willing to answer any and all questions, especially the question about his relationship that was up and down and then down again, and ultimately leading to Gary Richrath leaving the band by the late 80s. I thought he was very open about that, because for some folks, you know, just in any relationship, even if it's been, you know, in that case, 30 plus years removed. And of course, Gary passed away back in the mid teens, just a few years back, about 2015. So for a lot of band members, anybody else in a relationship, it's difficult to talk about those breakups. But I thought he was very forthcoming and acknowledged that, you know, hey, we had some very great times, especially as they build up to the success of High Infidelity 40 years ago in the spring of 1981. But by the late 80s, he said the person that one of the founding members of the band, Alan Gratzer, left the band. And that's when he and Gary started to break away, as he acknowledged that Alan was kind of the guy that kept the two of them together and focused and made sure that there was that balance between Kevin's kind of folk rock sensibilities and Gary's, you know, hard drive and rock and roll sensibilities as far as the direction of the band. And when someone, it's just like you and I like to riff on Seinfeld every now and then. Just think how different Seinfeld would be if George weren't in the mix, or Kramer, you know, all those people come together in a certain way and a chemistry develops. And if one leaves, then it's just not the same. And that was the case with REO Speedwagon. When Alan left the band, Alan Gratzer left the band in 87, 88, then all of a sudden Gary and Kevin just couldn't find that balance to keep it going.
Yeah, and one could argue that Larry David has found some new balance doing Seinfeld without Seinfeld on Curb Your Enthusiasm. But I think that balance was very an interesting part of the interview, but it seemed like that balance in 81 mixed with, I think Cronin mentioned, their lives were in disarray in 81, which brought the band closer.
Yep.
And helped create the context to make a huge album.
Yeah, they unintentionally came up with a concept album where all of the songwriting between the various members of the band and the stories they all had to share with each other had a commonality to it, and they ended up having an unintentional in concept album that worked very well. And of course, with rock and roll, just like with any other type of drama, anytime you've got that conflict and different emotions and all of that comes together a lot of times to make a great piece of art, and certainly was the case with High Infidelity, and it certainly, the themes of the album and the songs, the lyrics, just the way they put it all together certainly resonated with fans. Can't argue with selling over 10 million albums. That's, by any standard, just huge.
Yeah. 10 million albums is crazy, and I like what you said about commonality, because I think you mentioned that it was the fact that when people listened to the music, they could kind of hear themselves in it. They could kind of see themselves in the story, and it kind of spoke to them in a way that they could understand the messages. And, you know, it was really kind of just like a every person's band, you know. It was just something that kind of spoke to everybody. And I think that really says a lot about their popularity, particularly early on when they were kind of just starting out, but really made a name for themselves in this Midwest area, you know, selling out shows in like Madison, Wisconsin really early on. And just really neat how it speaks to Illinois, but it kind of speaks to everybody at the same time.
Yeah, it was a band that had that Illinois or Midwest ethic of working hard when it was time to work hard, but when it was time to play hard, they played hard. And they talk about, you know, loyalty to family and friends. And in the conversation with Kevin Cronin talking about the breakup of Gary Richrath leaving the band, that several years later they were able to play together a couple of different times, most notably at the concert in Bloomington for the tornado relief effort. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, he said, I was very glad that before Gary passed away that we were able to end our relationship on a good note, that we had reconnected, and while Gary never came back to the band full time, they were nonetheless able to play together one last time, or in fact a few last times, doing some encores and whatnot at a few concerts. So it was nice to see that aspect of, you know, family and friends was able to kind of reconnect all those years later between Kevin and Gary.
That's a great point. I thought that was a powerful part of the interview where they were almost like estranged family, right?
Right.
And getting back together with the family you choose was important. And to go back to the breakup, it seemed like that tied into Cronin's thought. Like, a young kid hits it big, and you think your problems are going to go away.
Right.
He ran into this sort of the more success, more problems situation, and that seems like the breakup happens not that long after that.
Yeah, a few years after the peak of High Infidelity, and then, of course, they had a couple of other albums there in the mid-80s that were successful, not nearly as successful, obviously, as High Infidelity. Those are kind of once-in-a-lifetime events that, you know, most bands dream of having, but nonetheless, it was a case where they finally came back full circle, and you could kind of see that maybe that was going to eventually happen in the relationship, because he did talk about 72, 73 when he first came on board with the band. He said, we were a little out of balance. He said, I just didn't quite fit in with Gary and vice versa. So he left the band for a while and then eventually came back 76, 77, and they made the relationship work for a good number of years and very successfully, but eventually it got to that point where, you know, sometimes you just have to part ways, and but eventually they're able to come around and have some reconciliation and end on a good note. The other aspect that I thought was interesting about the band was that once they started to hit their success in the late 70s, they went out and established themselves in the L.A. rock scene. And at that time, when they were looking for a new bass guitar player, they could have easily picked anybody from the Southern California music scene. But instead, they went back to the roots and grabbed a guy in Bruce Hall from Champaign to join the band, who's still with them today.
And I thought that story was really tied in well with that they're this Midwestern band, because the way they met, it was like at a house party, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a very Midwestern, I think it was almost a college town story where you met a guy and now he's also singing in your huge band.
Yeah, and if I could just really quickly just go back to the story of that breakup, what really touched me was the fact that there is this common narrative in, you know, rock and roll and all the stories that come out of it, that this internal conflict and hurt feelings and just really not getting along and all this constant, you know, bickering back and forth. But it's really something that comes out of rock and roll history, you know, like these forever arguments, the stuff that people never get over. Like, we never spoke again, and I'll never know what could have happened if we had, you know, been friends again. But that was such a unique part of the story, is that, you know, even if, you know, they spent time apart, didn't really get along for that long, but eventually did come back together for the sake of the music and, you know, kind of finding that common ground again and coming back together. That's really cool. I really like that part of the story.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I sort of want to ask Joe, and some folks might not know this, but before he was programming director at the ALPLM, long broadcast career. And do you find this with other bands? It seems like REO Speedwagon had this certain musical alchemy, balancing two different sounds. Is that common, or is this unique?
You know, the folk meeting up with the hard drive and rock and roll in some cases is a little unique for the way they were able to pull it off. But certainly there are a lot of bands over the years that have, you know, two people or three people that come kind of as the front people for the band that you really identify with as being part of the band. You know, like with the Beatles, obviously McCartney and Lennon were the driving forces for that band, although George Harrison, a talented musician and songwriter in his own right, and Ringo Starr eventually had solo success in the 70s as well. But, you know, certain members jump out from the very beginning. It's obvious, you know, they're the two people that really make the band happen. And with so many bands, as Kevin alluded to, he said when we, you know, hit High Infidelity and the success of that, we thought, okay, great, all of our problems, all of our insecurities, all the things that we've had to deal with and are gone, they're solved because we're this huge success. But it just leads to more problems and more insecurities and all of that. And I think that's true with just so many bands and in different ways. But as much as that eventually causes a problem for a band and in some cases to break up and never get back together again, that conflict also, I think, leads to some, just as in other forms of art, that conflict leads to creating some great art, some great music, some great drama, great writings, whatever the case may be, because a lot of that conflict can get tied into the music that you write, and you end up with very relatable pieces, because we all go through that in life of dealing with conflicts and emotions and all that. And when a band or a songwriter can put that into words, into music, it certainly is relatable to so many people.
Well, thank you very much, Joe, for a very cool interview with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. Thank you, Jake, for joining us in this fun conversation. And everyone out there listening, please come visit the State of Sound exhibit at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and keep an ear out for more episodes of the State of Sound podcast. We're working on a lot more, and we hope you stick around and check those out.
Of course, you can get tickets anytime for the exhibit and the rest of the museum when you go to presidentlincoln.illinois.gov and check out future podcasts right here on our special page, www.musicfromillinois.com.
This has been the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.